So in this phase of reboot, we're revisiting worship. And I do believe this, that American Christianity has sent unclear messages about what worship is. Do you agree with that? Because American Christianity, I think in an effort to make the Lord's Day, where the ecclesia gathers, to be about the non-Christian more than the Christian, that American worship and worship services have become more of about a musical production. And lights, and video, fog machines, and rotating groups of bands that honestly, like, they could be on a Billboard top chart. They're that good musically. But it's so much more. You see, everyone worships someone or something. Now, by worship, I mean this, that every single person, yourself and myself included, that we look to someone or we look to something to satisfy the deepest needs of our soul. It's just what you turn to may not necessarily be what I turn to. For rest and enjoyment, I may put on a Cubs game and take a nap. You may be like, that sounds terrible. It's about the Yankees, right? Well, I don't know about that. Some of you may turn to romance or to your career or to hobbies or sports or travel or entertainment to fill some kind of ache that's inside of you, some kind of emptiness or need. And as we begin this morning, you need to ask, why am I like this? Why is it I turn to work and overwork to make me feel better about myself, to make me feel more secure, or whatever it is for you? There was a 17th century French philosopher by the name, I don't do French well, Blaise Pascal maybe, I don't know. And he says this. He says, what else does this craving, this helplessness proclaim? But that there was once in man a true happiness, of which all that now remains is just empty print and trace. This he tries in vain to fill with everything around him. Ah, search the world, right? Seeking in things that are not there the help he cannot find in those that are, though none can help him. And here's why. Since this infinite abyss can be filled only with infinite and immutable object. In other words, God himself. Man, this French guy in the 1600s had it going on. Doesn't it echo what we just finished singing moments ago, Graves in the Gardens? And I think it echoes John 4. Blasé echoes something deep down that we know to be true. We acknowledge, especially as Christians, we have this angst. We have this disillusionment, this discontentment with ourselves and the world in which we live and its current condition, this emptiness, this lack of contentment and dissatisfaction. And we feel and we cry out, this is not how life is supposed to be. Right? Leukemia, cancer, loss of loved ones, loss of job, overwork, always being weary and tired, can never be the right marriage, never be the right family. Right? Deep down, we know that there's something wrong with ourselves and the world that we live in. And there's nothing that we can do other than to distract ourselves from it. Go on a 3-day vacation. Legislate this, legislate that. More education, more busyness, pay raise. And just disguise it for a little while. Why are we like this? Because of our foreparents. Because of Adam and Eve. Because the evil one spoke to Eve and said, did God really say not to eat? And she turned to the fruit that our God forbade and saw that it was a delight to her eyes. She switched her eternal wealth from God himself who created her to a piece of fruit. And you and I have been doing the same thing since then. Deep down, we know that fun or a romantic relationship, or marriage, buying a new house, eating a great meal, even filet, traveling to see the world, watching a football game, going to a concert. It can never fill the ache and emptiness that's going on inside of us. Why? God did not design those things to. That's why. But we keep going to those things over and over again. Only God can fill, as Pascal says, an infinite abyss that exists inside of us, because only God is infinite. So in this phase of reboot, we're going to refocus on what worship is and what worship is not. And we do have a lot of kind of loaded baggage that we bring into this room, especially if we've been a Christian for a while and have some exposure to church, because you think of worship and you think of what we just did for 15 minutes before I walked up. And though that could be worship, it's never less than that, but it's so much more than that. The question we are seeking to answer today is this: do you truly want your soul to be fully satisfied in a way that has never been satisfied? That's the question. See, the gospel claims that you are actually made to live forever. You're made to be eternal. And the gospel claims that you can only experience infinite and eternal satisfaction for which you were created when you find it met in the only infinite and eternal being, which is God himself, who made you in his image. And that's what today's about. Let's get to our proposition. I like how Nick said last week, oh yeah, your pastor likes propositions, so here you go. He's going to spend the next 3 years making propositional statements. It's so funny. The big idea is this, is that Christians see worship as this, as the experience and the enjoyment of Jesus. That's for the true satisfaction of their soul's thirst. That's what the well at Sychar teaches us today. Every person, from the Samaritan woman all the way down to you and I today, we all experience soul thirst, that only our physical thirst can mirror. And point two, we turn as human beings, because of Adam and Eve, we turn to physical things, finite things, to satisfy an eternal, infinite soul thirst. That's the human dilemma. Jesus offered living water, not another well to dig in her backyard. Jesus offered to build a well actually inside of her, because Jesus is living water, and Jesus is the well that she's looking for. And I think, honestly, whether you consider yourself to be religious or not, or just a good guy, or whatever it be, I think, honestly, underneath it all, that you're looking for. Everything that you do, everything you say, everything that you're pushing towards, because you really want to be satisfied at the end of the day. And Jesus claims that if you drink him, and this is figurative language, but to say it plainly, if you experience a personal relationship, a personal ongoing relationship with the God of the universe, that he will satisfy you time and time again. Today, tomorrow, every day until the eschaton. Christians know this to be true. That's why many of your heads are nodding. We've experienced this firsthand. Christians know what it is like to turn to physical things to satisfy spiritual thirst. We've tried it with romance. We've tried it with substances. We've tried it with hobbies and fun. We've tried it with career and travel, food and experiences. And it didn't fill me, right? But one day, like the Samaritan woman, Jesus found us drawing from a well. And he offered to us living water. And we took a little ladle of it, and we never looked back. Our perspective about pleasure, enjoyment, and satisfaction have been forever changed. It's like we've tasted filet, and we made that commitment to never go back to that drive-thru burger. So today we're going to go back to Jacob's well one more time, and we're going to see how Jesus alone provides for what the Samaritan woman and what you and I need the most. Not just another Gatorade, or not just another filet, or another vacation, or a pay raise, but the ending and the completion of our soul's thirst in living water. We're going to see how Jesus reframes our understanding of worship. I hope to do some corrective teaching on what America has taught us about worship. Worship is the experience of living water. It literally is taking a ladle and just drinking of Jesus. And then we're going to ponder how it is that Jesus alone can satisfy soul thirst. So let's jump into the pool and let's get started. Here's our first point. in our first set of verses, what I want you to see is that Jesus alone quenches a person's insatiable soul thirst. And I think for us to come to a common understanding and to truly get a resolution with Jesus being our living water is that we must all agree, you know, your soul and my soul, it's insatiable, right? There's a reason why we have songs in pop culture, can't get enough of your love, baby, right? It's like it's never ending. No matter like how much good stuff we have, we want more of it and more, right? That's why there's things that's all you can't eat. Spiritual thirst, soul thirst is insatiable. Pascal has it correct. We cannot satisfy our souls with finite and physical things. Square peg, round hole. My father-in-law would say, well, just frame it, right? He probably could, but it doesn't quite fit. And you don't know the long-term effects of square peg and round holing it. All people try to satisfy their soul with whatever they think is going to get them through the ache. They're not thinking long-term. They're thinking, how do I get through this feeling right now? What can I turn to? The Samaritan hears Jesus' invitation to taste living water. He offers her a well that will never run dry. And at first, she's doubtful of Jesus. We read it a moment ago. We're going to peel back into it right now. Because how can Jesus, a Jew, who has animosity supposedly towards Samaritans, how can Jesus, a stranger, give her water that is better than what her ancestors, her people, gave to her? So she asks Jesus, how can you be greater than our father Jacob? And Jesus said to her, you know what, your ancestor, the one that Jacob wrestled, an angel? No, all this was to point to me. Jacob needed the well to survive. Everyone who comes to Jacob's well for water will have to come again tomorrow and the next day and the next day. Yet anyone who comes to me as their well to satisfy their soul's thirst will be sated. Jesus is claiming right now to be the only one who can quench what is going on deep down inside of this woman and deep down inside of you and deep down inside of me. So let's see in verse 15 now. The woman says to Jesus, sir, okay, give me this water. But look at how she's just seeing in the moment right now still. Why does she want this water? Because she doesn't want to be thirsty. And she doesn't want to have to come all the way out of Sychar to Jacob's well to draw water. Two things are clear, I think. This woman is thirsty and this woman is tired. Do you see that? She is tired of coming at an atraditional time to draw water because she was a social outcast. 6 hour of the day. It's the heat of the day, not in the morning. She is tired, she is thirsty, and I think she speaks for all of us today. We are tired, and we are thirsty as well, deep down in our soul. She acknowledges her physical thirst and her physical weakness, but she doesn't yet understand that Jesus is speaking to quenching a deeper thirst in her physical thirst, her insatiable soul thirst. So what does Jesus do? I think the same thing that Jesus does with all of us in order for us to become Christians. He challenges the wells that we currently draw from. That's what he does. Let's see it right now. Verse 16, we think it's so strange unless we know that the entry level to Christianity is Jesus has to challenge your well. And then this verse makes sense. Verse 16, he says, go, call your husband, and come here. Jesus and the woman are talking about water and wells and physical thirst and satisfaction. Why does Jesus ask the Samaritan woman to go and call for her husband? Because we're learning something about Christianity and a relationship with the King of the universe. Jesus will confront and challenge the wells that we turn to over him, even if they are good wells. Even if the water is tasty and scrumptious. That was Smeagol. Should have done it in his voice. Then that would have helped a little bit. Is it tasty? Anyway. Oh. The woman, like you and I, have to have this experience. She must experience that she is so broken that she has turned to other wells for satisfaction that it can never bring. Yet, she must also experience that she is so loved by Jesus that despite that, he will still be her living water. So verse 17 and 18, here's how the woman responds. She tells Jesus, "I have no husband." And Jesus is like, okay. And he says, "You've correctly said I have no husband, for you have had five husbands." He's challenging the well right now. This is direct, clear truth. "And the one whom you now have is not your husband. This you have said truly." Jesus is proving himself to be God, Messiah, living water right now. He knows everything about the woman and about all of the wells that she has been drawing from for satisfaction. What we learn here is that this particular human being, though we all turn to wells, specifically, she has turned to the well of sex and romance and marriage to satisfy her insatiable soul thirst. And the gospel does not diminish. In fact, God is a creator of sex. God is a creator of love and the creator of marriage. Jesus, you're not going to see him today or ever in the Bible downplay sex, love, romance, marriage. What Jesus does is he says, this is not the well that you're meant to draw from. This is just a good well that God has given to you this time on earth. So this woman has been married five times. And now she is actually cohabitating. She has a man that is not her husband. You see why she comes to the well when no one is there? So she doesn't have to talk to anybody or be held responsible for her actions. This woman once pursued marriage as the means of satisfying her soul's thirst. And she is at least on her sixth relationship. Who knows? We can say at least six. And at this current point in time, she has given up on marriage. And now she is just solely focusing on sex as the well to satisfy her. She has swung, as Nick said last week, from the conservative approach, I'm going to do religion to make myself feel good, to the liberal approach, I'm just going to do whatever I want to do to feel better at the end of the day. But both approaches have left her empty. And honestly, both approaches, whether you want to be a conservative or if you're going to be liberal, it's going to leave you empty as well. If you make that the well, the basis of your satisfaction. Knowing Jesus means that he will challenge any well that we turn to quench our soul's thirst. I'm not discounting getting married. It's a beautiful well. I drink from it as often as I can. It's a glorious gift God has given. But do not make it the well that your soul draws from. You see, religion, your ethnicity, sex, marriage, you fill in the blank. They are pitiful wells to draw from, because every single one of those wells will run dry. No matter how much water you have drawn up from those wells, it is going to leave you thirsty. But Jesus offers you today, in this moment, a deeper well that will never run dry. Whether you are a Christian or whether you're not a Christian, deep down, I think that you know that whatever it is that you're literally turning to right now, it's only a distraction. It is never going to solve the ache that you have going down, deep down inside of you. Career won't do it. Because what happens when that job goes away? They find somebody younger and cheaper to do your job for you. Romance won't do it. What happens when you age and you wrinkle, right? Things begin to sag. You don't look the way that you used to. Are you offended, Vernon? Anyway, is this Gather or something? I mean, come on. No, it's family. That's why we're able to do this. It's not a production. But family won't do this either. Because what happens when those kids grow up and move out? I mean, eventually they're going to move out, right? Sometimes we don't want them to. And what happens when the kids become adults and they decide, I don't need to, nor do I want to have a relationship with you? And you've made it the basis of your value. Religion won't do it. Don't think religion's the answer. Because there's always somebody who has better gifts, who's serving more than you, who's giving more than you, who's getting more attention in the church than you. Religion won't do it. And the thing is, just an agnostic, ethical, though I think it's an oxymoron, lifestyle won't do it either. Because there's, once again, there's always somebody who's going to be more compassionate than you, more hospitable than you, more philanthropic than you. Money certainly will not do it, because there's always somebody who has more money than you. There's always a day you come home from work and something is broken. You get it? Whatever well you turn to cannot satisfy what is going on deep down inside of you. Why? Because God did not design those things to satisfy you in your deepest soul's thirst. They serve a different function. Money is the economy of the Christian to unleash God's generosity on the world. Right? Family is the training ground for God's view of creating Christians and raising them up in the Lord. Marriage is simply this deep, deep well that points to a unique relationship with Jesus and the church. They weren't never meant to be the well. Just little sips along the Godward way into the eschaton. Your soul was created by Jesus, the infinite one. And therefore, only Jesus can satisfy your infinite thirst. You see, on the cross, Jesus experienced physical, extreme physical and spiritual thirst. And Jesus, King of the universe, allowed himself to be thirsty so you could be sated. That's the gospel. But for this to happen, Jesus must confront and challenge the wells that you currently turn to for satisfaction if it's not him. If you have the well that's not Jesus, he's going to come out of Sychar, he's going to wait for you, and he's going to talk to you, he's going to challenge you. That's the gospel. But notice, Jesus did not condemn this woman for coming out to Jacob's well, nor did Jesus judge, challenge this woman because she has turned to physical relationships. That's how God has created us. Man was not created to be alone, so he makes a helper comparable, suitable to him, right? Jesus is telling the woman that these wells can never be the well. And likewise, through the woman, Jesus is telling you today, whatever it is that you've been turning to, God never put that into your life to be the well, but a well. Can you see what's going to happen over time? You draw so much water from that well of your romantic relationship or your job or your family, your kids, etc., whatever it is for you. This is a finite well. Cracks will develop. And it can't sustain because your soul thirst is insatiable. You have to redirect that into the one that will never run dry. To be a Christian means that you know you have run to other wells for satisfaction, and they have run dry. It hasn't worked out for you. You still have the ache, the disillusionment at the end of the day. And you know what? Augustine is a great example for us to consider because he is a part of our cloud of witnesses. Remember Hebrews 12? We talk about reading Christian biography, knowing the highs and lows of the Christians that have come before you. Augustine is great for us in this example. And I honestly think I would subtitle Graves in the Gardens Augustine's Song. Have you ever read his autobiography called Confessions? Augustine grew up with a non-Christian dad and a Christian mom. Y'all have ever been there? One of your parents are Christians, one of them are not. Augustine went through that. His mom's name was Monica, and she prayed for him decade after decade for his salvation. Augustine drew from every single well that was possible in the 3rd, 4th century Roman Empire. He turned to education. He was a highly educated man. He is a skilled rhetorician. He turned to philosophy to help him understand what was going on deep down inside of him, something called Neoplatonism, which we don't need to go over. But he learned about that, and he thought that was the answer for a time being, the philosophies of the world. He turned to sex. What was that? Anyway, it's a kind of good dramatic effect. Good production value, right? Turned the lights down low right there. It's perfect. He had a child out of wedlock, if you read his autobiography. And of course, he turned to substances. You could read some of the things that he did in those college years. That's very, I mean, you think like, I don't know, 1980s Animal House. No, this is a long time before that. Long time before that. But all these wells left Augustine empty. And one day he was reading his mom's scriptures in her garden and came across Romans, and his life was forever changed. In his confessions, Augustine writes this. Augustine says, "You, God, you stir man to take pleasure in praising you because you made us, not for other wells, you made us for yourself. And therefore, our hearts are restless until it finds its rest in thee." That's it. Do you get it? You were created by an infinite God. You are handcrafted in his image, which means there's your soul is not finite, it's eternal. It is infinite. And therefore, the thirst you feel deep down inside of you, you cannot turn to physical things to make it better. You will always be restless, anxious, until you find your anxiety met in Jesus. The old Presbyterian Catechism has it right. Its opening question is, what is the chief end of man? And they say, to glorify God. Oh, that religious jargon right there. But I love the next phrase. To glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Those Presbyterians had it right. Satisfaction begins when you confront the wells that you've turned to over Jesus. So worship is, okay, what well am I going to turn to experience satisfaction? Who do I hallow in my heart above all things? Now let's see Jesus, because he's going to move from, more specifically, from talking about wells to talking about worship. Let's get to point two. In point two, we see that Jesus, he redefines worship focused on a person and not a place. Here's the premise of religion. You do your normal everyday life, and then certain days or certain seasons, you leave where you are, you go to a place, you perform a religious action, and you don't think about it until the next week. You don't think about the people until the next week or the next festival or whatever it may be. Worship is a place. It's an event. It's a production. I firmly believe that all people are religious. All people worship something. Some worship, as we're getting ready, some worship at a football stadium, right? Go Bucks! Tampa Bay! Some worship at a baseball diamond. Go Cubs, go. Go Cubs, go. We sing that every time the Cubs win a game, which we've won like 78 this year. It's pretty good. Some worship around a race car track. You watch a car do this 500 times. You get so excited. Some worship at a concert, right? Man, if you look at concerts, it honestly looks like the American worship service. At these places, we present our bodies, do we not? We shout, we clap, we scream, right? Yet we come together as the assembly of Jesus. Called out by Jesus and called to the things of Jesus. Jesus, who created all things and created them, took the cross to redeem them. And we are mute and we are still. Do you see the inconsistency in that? All that's proving is that You think you're not religious, but you're religious. You just turn to a well that never runs dry. You may find religion useful, but you don't find Jesus beautiful yet. What Jesus is going to say right now is that worship is not a place and it's not an event. Worship is a person. It is personal between two or more people. So let's take a look at it. So the woman hears Jesus confronting her wells, and look what she does. She turns to religion. Look at verses 19 and 20. She says to Jesus, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." This woman is beginning to suspect that there is something more going on with Jesus than what she first thought. He just met her, yet he talks differently. He knows of her history. And despite knowing her history, as jaded and depraved maybe as it is, Jesus, as a man and as a Jew, is still talking to her. Not unclean, get away, like probably people would do today. But she doesn't put her guard down yet, does she? She arms herself with religion. She has a good defense against Jesus right now. She swings from the liberal way of life. I mean, five men. She's with a man right now. It's on her husband. Liberal way. Do what I want. And then she immediately jumps to the conservative end of the spectrum and begins using religion to argue with Jesus. All the same story. And all of this is an attempt to evade the experience of God as her well. And Jesus sees through it. Her tactic right now is all about worship. You see, Jews at this time worshiped in Jerusalem on Mount Zion. Jerusalem is surrounded by seven hills. Mount Zion is the great imagery of where the presence of God is. But long before David overtook Jerusalem, worship happened at other places on high mounts. Very ancient Eastern thing. You go to a mountaintop and you worship. You create an altar and sacrifice. Samaritans had a mount called Gerizim, not too far from where Sychar is. And so what she is saying is, you think worship is at Mount Zion, but we think worship is on Gerizim. Location, location. So where does worship really take place? On Zion or on Gerizim? No. Jesus says worship is not a place. Worship is the personal experience of drawing from the well that is the God of the universe. Now, you may have said, or you may have heard it say, someone may have said to you, or you've said to others, "I don't need to go to church to worship God." Have you heard that one? No, have you said that one? I agree, yet disagree with this statement at the same time. And this text is why I agree and disagree at the same time. Let's look at Jesus' next statement, verse 21. Jesus says, "Believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. Salvation is from the Jews." We see Jesus yet again challenging, confronting. And right now he is challenging the location-centric worship of both Judaism and Samaritans. You see, in less than 40 years, the Roman Empire is going to be so tired of Jewish rebellion that they are going to come in Jerusalem and completely and fully destroy Mount Zion, the Temple Mount of God, where all that's left now, almost 2,000 years later, is a wall that the Jews weep at. This should give you goosebumps. I think I've told you time and time again, other than the resurrection of Jesus, the biggest proof for me that Jesus is God is that he predicted what's going to happen to the temple, and then it happened. It's scary. It is scary good. So, worship is not Jerusalem. It's not Gerizim. And it is not 15310 Morris Bridge Road. Like, pastor, that's not a pastoral thing to say. Don't you want these, 20 seats to be filled? Well, yes and no, depending on what you mean. Real worship is not Zion, Gerizim, or Morris Bridge. Real worship is drawing from the well of Jesus. That's where I agree with the statement, but here's where I disagree with the statement. The majority of the people that I have experienced who have said this don't go to church. And they are not, wherever they are, using their location to put them in some sort of physical posture to experience the God of the universe. It's an excuse to stay away from church. So maybe you have, like, you know, 90 minutes of peace and quiet in their house, or whatever it is they want to do instead. But this statement reveals that they don't have a heart for God, they don't understand God, they don't have a heart for God's people, and they do not understand the vitality of having relationships with God's people. You see, Jesus took on flesh to redeem, specifically, Paul says, the church. He purchased the church. He has sheep that Abba gave to him, and he lays his life down for the sheep. Definitive article. There's a group of people, the people of God that Jesus died for. And he is preparing the church as a bride for her wedding day that's called the eschaton. You see, statements like this reveals that a person, just like everybody else, draws from wells other than Jesus. And that's okay. But also in the same vein, will you allow, if you're that type of person, will you allow Jesus to come and challenge it? If your well is so indestructible, if your well is doing so well for your life right now, then you should welcome the critique. You should welcome the challenge. There shouldn't be any cracks in that well then, if it really is working out. Worship is not a place, it is a person. Worship is a well that you draw from to satisfy your soul's thirst. So what is worship? Jesus gives us a pretty clear understanding of elements of worship in these next two verses. Let's take a look at it. Verse 23, he says, an hour is coming, and now is, when true worshipers, he's clarifying now, they worship the Father in spirit and truth. And then, like to add on to this, he says that the Father seeks these kinds of people to be his worshipers. Totally different than the American worship service. Then verse 24, God is spirit, so therefore those who worship him must worship in spirit, or with your spirit, and in truth. I think it's clear that Jesus wants this woman, for you and for me, to understand what worship is and what it is not. Worship is the experience of God as spirit and truth. And then this overwhelming idea that the God of the universe, whatever you think is the most beautiful thing in creation right now, like Linda was showing me, our kids next door, they're taking a look at some like crazy like nebula somewhere in the universe, and she showed me a picture of it. It's gorgeous. It's amazing. Whatever you consider to be the most beautiful thing on this planet, the God who created that says, I seek you to be a worshiper of me. He created that, and yet he wants you. And I think this challenges the modern American notion of the worship service. Because in America, churches design large-scale production mass services where people pursue God with little thought or space in a service to realize, no, God is pursuing you. Worship isn't about you pursuing God how you want through worship. Worship, which is music. Worship is God pursuing you in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus so you can experience a well that will never run dry. And this means that congregational singing that we do every Sunday morning, it serves a much deeper purpose than what you currently may think is going on in these worship services. It's not about the music. It's nothing less, but so much more. And congregational singing isn't about you or your musical preferences. I can tell you story after story of worship wars that I had in the early 2000s with people, even people in this church when I first got here, because I didn't do hymns, or I didn't play piano, because I didn't know how to play piano yet. I basically learned so this church could be like, okay, play piano. I play guitar when I first showed up. Music isn't about, worship isn't about your musical preferences. So I do believe that our perspective on congregational singing needs to be challenged, confronted, and we need to grow. It's a point of reboot. You see, our gatherings as a body, as a family, what they are, it's our familial opportunities to draw from the well of God together. Like, that was good, wasn't it? That's what you should be doing after service, where you're driving home, you're like, oh man, this sermon was so long. Like, did you taste that? Man, that was good. At least I hope. You see, we have two weekly opportunities, for the most part, during the year, to draw water for your soul together, familially. So how are you spending it? How do you spend these moments? Now let's talk for a brief moment what Jesus means by worship in spirit and truth. So worshiping Jesus, talking about the spirit side, is a spiritual experience. It goes beyond the physical. Jesus reinforced that his Father is spirit. So though it is what we do with our bodies, it's so much more than what we do with our bodies or what we don't do with our bodies. It is spirit. It's something that's done on the inside. And I think that's why Jesus last week told this woman, hey, I can give you a well inside of you that you can draw from the rest of your life. But worship is also an experience of truth. Worshiping Jesus for the satisfaction of your soul thirst will always involve his word and his truth. You experience his truth and his promises, and your soul is satisfied. When you go through a hard time and you read a promise like Philippians 4 that says, my God will supply all of your needs richly in Christ Jesus, and then that same season, God provides for everything that you need, that's so good. And Christians have experienced that time and time again. And that is why our gatherings, God willing, will always be centered on Jesus' word, the scriptures. And I've said this over the years, over the decade, there's a reason why this lectern pulpit is between you and I, and the scriptures are right here in my manuscript. And when this is removed and just becomes the sage on the stage, you need to sit me down. Because worship is truth. Let's get to our application now. So our application today is for you then to set Jesus as the real answer for what your soul is looking for. Stop turning to physical wells to satisfy insatiable, eternal, spiritual thirst. I firmly believe that the answer, finding the answer to your soul's thirst, is the most important thing you can do in this life. I mean, in one sense, our American founders do have it right. Life is about the pursuit of happiness. It's just that we may differ a little bit as to what true happiness is. This woman had to discover that she was drawing from wells for her soul that was always going to leave her dry. And I think you too, if you are not a Christian, you need to discover that you are drawing from wells for your soul that will always leave you dry. This is the question. If that relationship, that romance relationship you've had, putting all of your being, your value into your marriage or to your family or to your career, your hobby, whatever it is, that substance, if it was meant to satisfy your soul's thirst, don't you think it would have done it by now? I mean, some of you spent years doing these things. Don't you think it would have scratched the itch by now? But it hasn't. Instead, you're just as achy. You're just as discontent and disillusioned as before. So let's see how the woman responds to all of this. I think she begins to get it. Verse 25. She says, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. And when that one comes, he will declare all things to us. She's getting it. Messiah knows everything. Jesus knows everything, at least everything about me. The woman was resistant to Jesus at first, was she not? She relied on her ethnicity. You know, Jacob dug this well for me and my family. She used religion to evade Jesus. There's no greater place that you can avoid Jesus than in the church. There's no greater place. It's not going out fishing this morning or going on vacation. It's just being in church. It's the best place you can evade Jesus. But over time, Jesus' grace and truth softened her heart. Back in verse 19, she's like, okay, sir, you could be a prophet. And now in verse 25, she has this idea that Jesus could be the Messiah, the one that she has been waiting for. Because she knows that Messiah, her coming deliverer and redeemer, will declare all things. So she's asking a question underneath this statement. Usually I take questions and put them into statements for you. Now I'm taking the statement, I'm going to put it into a question. She's asking Jesus through this statement, are you the one? Are you the well? Are you the one we've been waiting for? In application, I think before this moment passes you by, you have to ask the same thing for your own soul to Jesus. Jesus, are you the one? Not this person. Are you the one? Is Jesus the well that your soul has longed for? Underneath the work, underneath the romance, underneath the entertainments, you fill in the blank, all the fighting for money and rest and intimacy and connection. Underneath it all, that it was Jesus all along that you have been thirsting for. Well, how does the King of the Universe respond? Simple phrase. Let's look at it. Verse 26. He simply says, I who speak to you am he. Anybody with their Bibles out? Do you notice anything about the word he? It's added, it's italicized, which our translators let you know. They add to make sense. I mean, English, you need a subject and an object, right? You know, for it to make sense. So they add the he. But let me tell you what it says in Greek. Some of you may laugh depending on how many commercials you know from the past, but it's literally like Lego, ego, emi. It's kind of like what's kind of said. You know, Lego, my ego? Okay, good. But ego, emi, it's just like saying, I am in Hebrew. And those of you who are nodding your heads, you know a little bit about the name of God. Chaya Yavah, Yahweh, the eternal one. I am who I am. Jesus simply responds and just says, ego, emi. Jesus tells the woman and Jesus tells you, I am the well. I am the one who will quench your soul's thirst. It isn't more time, more intimacy, more money, more vacations, more romance, more fun. It is me. It is ego emi. I am he. You see, your soul's thirst is insatiable until it is satisfied by Jesus and in Jesus. So think about it this way. The woman leaves the well, totally unfazed, untouched by Jesus. She is on her sixth attempt for soul satisfaction through romance. What do you think is going to happen to her in this sixth case? She's fine, just going to get it. What happens when the well that is that man runs dry? Where will it leave her? The same goes with you and the wells that you're turning to today. Eventually, the wells that you turn to, a fun night out, work, marriage, romance, family, fun, hobbies, entertainment, vacations, whatever it may be, it will leave you dry, right? But what if today you see those wells for what they are? Many of them are good gifts from God. See them for what it is. But then leave those wells at the same time as the source for your soul's satisfaction. And instead you turn to Jesus as the well for your insatiable soul thirst. He promises you that if you do this, you will never run dry. You'll never run dry. Psalm 1 says, you'll be like a man who's firmly planted by streams of water. Evergreen. Your leaf never, never withers. The call today is for you to set Jesus as the real answer to what your soul is looking for. And what I want you to consider today is that when you experience Jesus as the answer for your deepest soul thirst, it changes you personally and it changes you publicly. And that's going to lead us more into the fall as we get into ministry on the inside of the church and to non-Christians as well. It changes you personally and it changes you publicly because worship is a witness. So let's talk personally for a moment. When Jesus becomes the well that you draw from for your soul satisfaction, it changes you personally, inside, privately. You no longer seek the well of work or money or romance, fill in the blank, to satisfy your soul. And because of this, you can see those things, work, romance, fun, hobbies, entertainment, vacations, whatever it is, you can see them for how God has created them to be in your life. A well, but not the well. Little foretastes of glory divine, like the old hymn writer says. Beautiful foretastes. But it also changes you publicly. It changes your perspective of people. It changes your perspective of Christians, non-Christians, coming to this church, going to the grocery store, fill in the blank. Or when you go on vacation, it changes everything. So there's a principle I want you to consider. And it comes from the great Oswald Chambers. Oswald Chambers, you may or may not know this. My Utmost for His Highest was the first devotional I ever read when I became a Christian. And I read it from 15 to probably 25, year in and year out. I was telling Tisa this morning, I miss Proverbs. You know, we're doing in Keller's devotional. He's gone back to his Proverbs devotional this week. I miss that Proverbs devotional so much, I'm bringing it next year. So, I mean, it's going to be on our list for next year again, so we can brush them off. Oswald Chambers was baptized by the great Charles Spurgeon. And here's what he says about worship. He says, the measure of the worth of public activity for God is the private, profound communion that we have with Him. Chambers is trying to help you and I understand something about worship. Your public life for God is dependent upon the personal experience you have with Jesus all by yourself. If you are drawing from Jesus as the well to satisfy your soul's thirst, it changes how you see people. It changes your perspective on everything. It changes how you serve. It changes how you give. It changes how you come to this church. And this has personal and corporate implications for us as we reboot for another 10 years of weekly gatherings, does it not? So I want us as the people of God at Branchton to develop this principle. There is a relationship between how you are drawing on Jesus as your well personally and how you draw from the well of Jesus corporately. And we can use this as a litmus for each other. I'm not saying we're all charismatic worship service, we're all just doing jumping jacks during worship service. I'm not saying that. Spirit and truth is worship. Okay. So here's a couple considerations. This year we started a new priority in our worship services that I select and plan out scripture readings for you. And every single time I say, if you're able, would you stand to honor that the God of the universe who says, let there be light, will also want to speak to you through His word. Why do we want you to stand? Because standing changes your posture, literally. And I think you know now as human beings that what you do physically can have an impact on what's going on with you emotionally. That's why even secular psychologists say you're going through depression, open up the windows in your home, go for a walk, right? Same premise. We stand because it literally puts you in a new position and it takes your focus off of yourself. Because worship is God's pursuing you. We also want you to consider the songs that we sing. So what that means is it's okay to go through a worship service where our worship leader is presenting songs to you to sing and you just think through the lyrics. That's okay. That can be worship. Because the Shema says, love the Lord your God with all of your hearts, but then what? All of your noggin. Yes, we do want you to. You could raise your hands to express, as we've spoken before, just as plants will raise themselves up when they're thirsty, that we too will raise our hands to express that we're thirsty for Jesus. You can do that. You can also bow down low if you feel need to, because God is so great. We're singing how great is our God, and you feel this small. That's loving the Lord your God with all of your strength, your body. We want you to look to others. Hold their hands. Put your arms around each other. Pray together. Sing together. Because each act is just a little bit of a sip from the well of Jesus, corporately. This is how we love God with all the heart, mind, soul, and strength when we're together. And we want you, like it's a 7-course fine dining Michelin star restaurant meal, to savor every single bite of our worship service. Because this doesn't just happen overnight. It's planned out so you can drink from the well that is Christ Jesus our Lord. There's a relationship between how you draw on the well of Jesus when we're together and what could be going on when you're all by yourself. And we want you to see that both your personal and corporate time with Jesus as an opportunity to drink from the well again. Jesus says, are you the one? Or sorry, the woman says to Jesus, are you the one that we are really looking for? And Jesus says, ego, emi, I am.